From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Justice Department said today that the redacted Mueller report will be released Thursday morning. We're also digesting President Trump's comments that he is considering sending asylum-seeking migrants to so-called sanctuary cities. Officials initially said the plan was no longer on the table, but Trump contradicted them Friday, telling reporters, "We'll bring them to sanctuary city areas and let that particular area take care of it." And of course, this past weekend, Representative Ilhan Omar's comment about 9/11 brought on a presidential Twitter storm. Should she have been more articulate? Is he ginning up hateful attacks on her? NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
The early reporting about this sanctuary city plan to send migrants to these so-called sanctuary cities, early reporting was that it was to punish Democrats. Then on Sunday, White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley told NPR the plan should be seen as extending an olive branch to Democrats. Let's listen.
It's not political retribution. If anything, you should consider it on the Democrat side to be an olive branch. You've asked us to work with you on some things. We've put forth time after time, solution after solution. They will not come to the table. So the logical answer is to give them something they want.
Okay, first of all, sanctuary cities aren't about encouraging undocumented immigration. It means local police won't do the job of federal officers in deporting them. So that they can, the officers, have trust in their communities. Put that aside, does anyone believe this was an olive branch?
Sure, I'm sure some people do. But this is actually something that has to do with the White House trying to clean up a mess that it created. This is the spin after, you know, there was a report about the president's potential plan to do this with Stephen Miller, the advisor in the White House, who's a hardliner on immigration, who came up with this, that it was shot down by immigration officials. And then because it became public and the president decided to lean into it, this is the kind of spin that you're seeing from the White House. But the fact is, the White House didn't talk to Democrats beforehand to try to make this something that was a plan that they would work together on. This was seen almost purely as political retribution. The president even hinted as much in his tweets on Friday. So, you know, this is that's just a lot of spin.
Yeah, and there's huge costs of huge questions about cost and legality. So those will be taken up. But I want to move to the president's attacks on the Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar, who said she's now receiving more death threats than usual after the president tweeted an edited video of her comments at an event last month sponsored by the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Now, first of all, she said that organization was founded after 9/11. That is incorrect. It was founded in the mid-90s. But she went on to say it was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties, meaning Muslims. I was in New York this weekend, huge cover of the Post that said, you know, people did something, here's your something, and a huge picture of the Twin Towers aflame. The president retweeted a video that combined some of her comments with footage of that terrible day. Was she too dismissive of 9/11? Is he trampling on sacred ground, as Speaker Pelosi says? What are you hearing?
Well, you mentioned Speaker Pelosi, and she's definitely somebody who has tried to tell Ilhan Omar to, you know, maybe be a little more measured in what she's tweeting about and what she's talking about. And you have the president looking to inflame what he sees as a potential political wedge that he can use. The fact is, this is completely controversial subject matter that is being handled by this president in a way that would be very different than George W. Bush, for example. And he was somebody who Ilhan Omar mentioned in one of her tweets about whether he took terrorist attacks seriously or not. And of course, the president did, President Bush. But President Bush, remember, days after 9/11, went to a mosque to calm things down, to talk to the American people directly and say that he stands with Muslims. And you don't have the president of the United States currently doing that. And I think that's the big difference.
Yeah. I just want to ask you your thoughts now on the Mueller report, said to be released Thursday morning. What are you – I mean, we've been hearing the president today tweeting out about how my campaign was spied on. We're not going to forget it. His former aide, Carter Page, going on CNN this past weekend talking about we were spied on. What are you – we got about a minute here. What are you looking to hear in this report now, Thursday morning?
Well, I think if you had to keyword one word in this 400-page report or so, would be exonerate. I think that that was a tantalizing bit in one of the quotes from Robert Mueller that Bill Barr, the attorney general, mentioned in his four-page letter talking about whether or not President Trump was exonerated when it came to obstruction of justice. And Mueller made a point of saying he was not exonerated, but that Barr and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, made the determination not to go and try to prosecute him. So I'm looking for that, and I want to see where he puts all these dots together when it comes to all these other indictments and prosecutions we've seen and how that didn't add up to conspiracy with the Trump campaign in Russia.
People are going to be using software. Look for the word exonerate. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Several states had to reckon with severe weather over the weekend. The National Weather Service says at least 17 tornadoes whipped through Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. At least 8 people, including 2 children, are dead as a result. Stephanie Abrams is a meteorologist at the Weather Channel. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been watching this storm sweep across the country from west to east. Give us a sense of the scale of this system. It sounds like it's enormous.
It is. And these storms, they go from border to border. You know, it's not like it's just one sector of the U.S. We're talking the Canadian border all the way down to the Mexican border. That's how big it is.
And the reason for the extent of it is it variations in temperatures or what?
Yeah, you know, overall weather, if you've ever thought about why do we actually have weather, just kind of a layman term, easy way to think about it. I like to say we're trying to balance the cold and the warm, right? The warm equators and the cold poles. Think about in the summertime when you get daytime heating, it gets really, really hot, thunderstorms pop up and it cools us off. So that's kind of a gist. Obviously, there's much more that goes along with it, right? But that is some of the fuel that will prompt this sort of thing. And then you have winds at all different layers of the atmosphere. It's a very complex thing. I think it's much more complicated than people might think, actually.
Well, that's why we have people like you to tell us exactly what's behind what's going on. So how far into tornado season are we now? Because we're talking about at least 17 tornadoes over the weekend.
Yeah. So we're just getting into it. I mean, really, April, May, June is when we see that peak of tornado season.
And that means we have a good amount of time left. How is it looking?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, we do. This is when the seasons start to change. The temperatures change. The whole pattern overall is going to change. You know, for the last several months, we were in winter where you had that northern jet stream that was dipping down. That allowed all that cold air to come in. And obviously, to get severe weather, you need warm air because that warm, moist air rises up and causes those thunderstorms. And so we're just seeing a shift in what's happening overall in the atmosphere into our warmer season, which I think a lot of people are happy about. Not so happy, of course, to get the severe weather that comes along with that.
And is it unusual for this time of year for 17 tornadoes to strike?
I wouldn't say it's unusual. We're definitely above average, you know, with the number of reports, not only tornadoes, but there's a lot of wind damage, a lot of hail damage. It was an above average day, if you will, but it's not out of the ordinary. It's not one of those shocking things. Though I do understand for people that don't deal with it all the time, this can come very shocking to them.
Are heavy winds out of the ordinary, the ones that we're having this time of year?
You know, no, I know we had in even just Philadelphia. I know that all those tornadoes, of course, were in the south, but even Philadelphia had a wind gust over 60 miles an hour, 63. And so you still can get really strong winds out of these thunderstorms that can do damage as well.
And at the same time, in the north Midwestern states, spring has yet to arrive.
Can you believe it?
Snowstorm in Chicago that canceled more than 1,000 flights yesterday. Is that a typical mix?
Yeah, and this is a very typical spring storm. We're on the front side of it. You get all that severe weather that's tapping into, you know, that Gulf moisture, that warm, moist air. But then there's still enough cold air getting pulled down on the north side of it where you'll get the snow. Now, obviously, getting 8-9 inches this time of year, not ideal and not average either. You know, Chicago gets 2 to 3 inches or something on average this time of year, but it's not completely out of the ordinary.
Now that the system is behind us, should parts of the country, and if so, which parts, be bracing for another?
Look, we have another. It's really actually coming Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So from the Midwest all the way to the South, everyone in those areas need to watch again all the way from midweek towards the end of the week.
What do you expect that to bring with it?
you know, unfortunately, it does look like we're going to see a lot of hail with this one coming in. And then wind again. I mean, we have thunderstorm wind right out of these smaller thunderstorms. And then you have what we call synoptic scale wind. So you know how you see on a weather map, a low pressure with a cold front or a warm front? We call that size of a feature on a map a synoptic scale system. So as we get into Friday, that low pressure in the fronts and its interaction with some other systems is going to cause just hugely windy conditions that are going to be from the Midwest to the Northeast down to the South, which causes a lot of delays with the airplanes and whatnot. And then, of course, once you get a thunderstorm, you can get strong, very localized winds out of those.
Your job is not easy, and it's very busy. Stephanie Abrams, meteorologist at the Weather Channel. Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You might be familiar with comedian, actress, writer, TV host Chelsea Handler from her 5 best-selling books, her late-night talk shows Chelsea and Chelsea Lately, or her stand-up. Here she is at Hollywood's Laugh Factory.
I don't like people who have a baby and then bitch and moan about it. You know, they're like, oh, my baby weight, I can't lose my baby weight. It's like your baby's 7. You're a fat now, okay? Why don't you put down that matzo ball for 2 seconds?
She is irreverent, brash, strong. Her fans worship her. Her growing staff dotes on her. In the beginning of her new memoir, it takes 2 live-in assistants to get her bedroom remote to work. Others pick up after her dogs. Lots of first-world problems. And then, bam, my brother died when I was 9. And we're off with her on a very sober look at an event she can only allow herself to weep about decades later. The memoir is Life Will Be the Death of Me, and Chelsea Handler joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It was quite a shock. Quite a shock, the rabbit hole you go down. I just want to start sort of at the end. Have you heard from other people who've said, this helped me, I lost a brother? I can't tell you how many people I know who've lost a sibling when they were young and it just gets shut out.
Yeah, I've heard from people on social media and such. So many people. I got a message yesterday, I don't remember on which one, saying a woman who said she hadn't spoken to her sister in 13 years and mm-hmm. that she read my book and called her sister and her sister read my book after she sent it to her and that they're meeting. It's something that we all have experienced, loss and grief. So, you know, it's really moving.
Yeah.
And I mean, to have an impact on something like that is not something I ever thought I would have.
We'll talk about, you know, who you were when this all started to happen, when it started to crack open. I mean, because you write about all the many people who help you, you know, run your life. I was dreading turning a page thinking, oh, someone's going to go in the bathroom with her, you know, to help mm-hmm. her.
Yeah.
You know, you have all these people helping you
it's
through
domestic
your day.
Amnesia is what I call it.
Your trips on private planes, chauffeured cars.
Just a ton of things being thrown at you and you saying yes because you're like it, you know, and I loved it. I was like, oh, this is great. I wanted to be a public person. I wanted to have my independence. I was, you know, I wanted to be a strong woman and a strong role model and never depend on anybody. And I thought that was because I was just strong. I didn't think it was a direct link to what happened at 9 years old when my brother promised me he'd be back shortly mm-hmm. from his trip to the Grand Tetons. And then him leaving and never returning, mm. it changed my dynamic and my the narrative in my head and kind of helped me get stuck in that place of a 9-year-old brain with regard to men and with regard to relying on anybody in your life. Mm. Because it seemed to me after he died and what happened to my family that no adults were reliable. I couldn't depend on my father. He was gone in his corner of grief and never came out of it. Mm. And, you know, tried to sue the people my brother was with. My brothers and sisters were all dealing with their own pain. My mom was just trying to keep us going. I didn't give myself enough credit and enough room to talk about that. I thought I didn't have to.
Well, and there was something going on with the family even before this happened. It's an interesting family.
It's a bit Sanford and Son.
You're talking about the sitcom Sanford and Son, the hilarious family of junkyard dealers scamming for cash. In your family, I love this moment where you're describing your father to your psychiatrist, Dan, and you're describing your father as kind of a flim-flam man. And Dan says, oh, like a used car salesman? He said, no, he was a used car salesman.
You know, it was very clear from a very early age that this was not a traditional family. My father was a used car dealer, which meant he was home all the time, and he sold cars out of our driveway. It's not like he had a business to go to. You know, he was a mover and a shaker and not the most honest moral character.
Con man.
Yeah, and if he had been more successful, he could have done more damage. So luckily, he wasn't more successful. So it was a little bit of instability in that way, but there were six of us growing up, of which I was the youngest, and my brother who died, Chet, was the oldest. So
13 years or something, your senior.
Yeah. And we were bookends, you know. He was my first crush. He was like my first boyfriend in a way because he took me everywhere with him and I loved him, you know. Yeah.
Well, also maybe, I mean, your mom spent a lot of time sleeping. Sounds lovely, but
like
she was just a sleeper. And your dad is cheating and maybe, as you say, maybe even stealing from people. Chet was your Peter Pan, your parents, your everything.
Yeah, he was the head of the family in a way. Like, he was the head of the children. You know, he was the oldest, so we all looked to him. If somebody needed anything, like, if we wanted pizza, I would go in and ask my dad because I was the youngest and cute and a loudmouth, so that worked for that. But if we needed serious stuff, Chet was the one. And our family was non-traditional. You know, we were always the family in the neighborhood that everybody kind of was like, oh, God, look at their driveway, look at their, you know, used cars everywhere. Growing up it was embarrassing.
Well, it was, I mean, your mom, who, again, sounds so sweet, thought nothing of sending your four-year-old sister to school with her siblings until the school called and said, you can't do that. You can't send a kid to school that isn't in school yet. Or you're the kid that's sitting there or walking home 5 miles because your parents just didn't pick you up.
My mom once came to pick me up from school on my birthday. I was in third grade. And I was like, can you please take me to lunch on my birthday? She said, of course. And at lunch, I went down to the principal's office. I waited and I waited and waited. And she never came. And I finally, when I went home that day at 3 o'clock, I walked home to school and I was furious. You know, when I walked in hysterically crying, I was like, well, how could you not come and get me on my birthday?
Yeah.
And she said, I was there. I parked right outside where I drop you off in the morning and you never came out. I'm like, Mom, you have to go and sign me out. I'm 9. You have to go into the school and come and get me. She wasn't intentionally leaving me out of her thoughts or forgetting to pick me up. They just didn't.
Well, she also wasn't Jewish, but you don't find that out till much later. And yet there's, you know, there's also this incredible bonding, incredible love, an incredible older brother. We're finding this out with you. You kind of take us through your sessions with Dan, the very patient psychiatrist, as you're telling this story haltingly. Yeah, he's going to go on a hike and he's going to come home and he just doesn't.
Yeah. You know, in your 9-year-old brain, that is a rejection. You know, he went off and let himself be killed when he told me he would never leave me. So my 9-year-old brain didn't have the vocabulary to understand. Intellectually, I got that it was an accident. Emotionally, he lied to me.
Yeah.
He lied to me and you left me and you never came back. So,
like everybody else who never picked me up.
Right. And then, you know, my dad was so gone. So I was screaming and crying for attention after my brother died. And my dad had none for me. He just would be like, get out of my face. So it was a shift for our entire family. You know, it took me until I was 40 years old to understand that I had so much anger that I didn't understand why until the election, which was a huge trigger for me, as it was for millions in this country. And that election represented the feeling I had when I was a little girl and the whole world became unhinged. And I lost it again. Mm-hmm. And this time I had the resources and the knowledge to try and sit down with somebody and get to the root of it, because I wanted to be coming from a place of positivity and optimism, not anger and outrage.
We'll talk more about that process. And we should say, you're very funny while you're going through this. Again, this is the most patient psychiatrist in the world. You know, you once showed up stoned because you forgot and you took an edible on the way there. And
That happens a lot,
as it turns out. A large part of what your whole journey was about, and you hate that word journey, okay, but a large part of what it's all about is discovering that you actually had no empathy.
That was an awakening, to be able to identify what I was missing and thinking, you know, I'm a fixer. I want to show up and I want to fix your life. If my girlfriend has a problem, I will be there every single day at the edge of her bed. But I never went to those people's houses and thought about what they were going through. I had sympathy. I wanted to make them better. But I never thought, oh, what's this woman going through right now?
What are they feeling?
What does it feel like to
well,
be her?
Was that part of that? Maybe you don't, you were, there were so many feelings you weren't having.
Well, I think my whole career has been about telling everybody what's wrong with them without ever taking a really hard look at myself.
Yeah. And actually now you're doing a documentary on white privilege, the thing you recognized in yourself.
Yes, privilege, exactly. Yeah. The older I get and the more awake I've become, and after the election especially, you realize what an advantage it is just to get through life with white skin. It's not that every white person has immense privilege. It's an advantage over people who don't have white skin. Mm. So that's what I learned, to stop crediting yourself with all of your success and take into account all the optics and all the surrounding information. And for me, that was so important because I felt like I had just made a career being a loudmouth for so long, and I wanted to do something more.
Well, what do you say to the people who might be listening to this and thinking, wow, I tuned in to hear a completely beeped Chelsea Handler put down of fill in the blank, and she's being serious. Is Chelsea Handler going to be funny still?
That's where the cannabis comes in. No, of course. You know, that muscle is fit and ready to roll.
Right.
This other stuff is what I needed more of.
Yeah.
This seriousness and thoughtfulness and to think about talking before talking.
You've strengthened your relations with your surviving siblings. Where is Chet now? Where is he now in your life?
In my mind, now that I have a deeper understanding of awareness, of mindfulness, that people aren't really gone, I believe that he's, like, not that, you know, people die and they're sitting around floating above your body, you know, not that stupid nonsense. I believe that, you know, he'll always be a part of me, and so will my mom. Like, the people that we love are with us, and we should be spending our time honoring them instead of grieving for so long. We can grieve because we need to get that out, but we have to honor those people. And the way to honor them is by fixing yourself and getting healthy. And then, you know, I get to write a book about my dead brother. That's privilege, you know, and it's going to be a New York Times bestseller. That's privilege.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm happy I wrote this book, even though I'm crying.
Well, those tears have definitely been dislodged. Chelsea Handler. The book is Life Will Be the Death of Me. Yes, it will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
The Department of Homeland Security announced this month it will grant an additional 30,000 H-2B visas. That means more workers from outside the U.S. will be allowed to come here to take seasonal jobs. Daniel Costa is with the Economic Policy Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Where is the pressure coming from to issue 30,000 more visas at a time when the president says this country is full?
The pressure is mostly coming from employers in the landscaping, construction, forestry, seafood, meat processing, and hospitality industries. They're the biggest users of the H-2B program, and every year they claim that there aren't enough U.S. workers who want to work in these jobs, and that they also don't have enough H-2B visas to hire workers in that program for those jobs.
Okay, they say they don't have enough workers. Some of the pushback, as you know, on the other side is that these H-2B workers are depriving Americans of jobs and also suppressing wages. Is there evidence for that?
I think, first of all, there have been claims that there are labor shortages in these occupations. And I think if you look at the data going back a number of years, you can see that there isn't a lot of evidence of labor shortages. But the main problem with the H-2B program is that employers don't have to do very much to recruit U.S. workers. And they've are often able to use loopholes in the wage rules to pay less to H-2B workers than what the going rate is for the jobs.
How difficult is it to get an employee from a different country, say from Jamaica, than from Georgia?
It is not that difficult. All they really have to do is go through the Labor Department and submit information about the jobs to the state workforce agencies. And they also have to advertise in a local newspaper on two separate days, one of which has to be a Sunday. And we've seen the absurd result of this in the Washington Post reporting in their Apply by Fax story, where they revealed how Trump's companies were advertising in the newspaper, but workers could only apply by fax. Obviously, there are a lot of workers in the labor market these days who've never even seen a fax machine. And you know, one of the ways that employers can get around hiring U.S. workers, they don't have to recruit nationally. So they have to jump through a few hoops, but they get the certainty of having a worker, and they also, employers own and control the H-2B visas, so they know that the worker can't leave because the visas tie the workers to the employer.
When you talked about the pay disparity between a U.S. citizen and someone who comes in from another country under the H-2B visa program, what might it be for someone who is doing some landscaping work over the summertime?
So on average, H-2B hourly wage was $12.94, and the average wage nationwide for that job was $14.28. But in some of the H-2B occupations last year, like in construction, employers saved on average over $4 per hour by hiring an H-2B worker instead of a U.S. worker.
So for opponents who say that hiring H-2B workers deprives Americans of jobs, it sounds like there is evidence of that.
Well, from my perspective, I think it's good to use immigration to fill labor shortages and to bring in workers when we need them. And I think under H-2B, they can be underpaid, and there's no way for them to stay permanently. So what you end up having is workers who come in every year for 20 years and are permanently temporary. So I think we need real reforms to have a program that isn't just used as a way to trap workers in jobs where they can't leave.
Speaking to us about the H-2B visa program, Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you.
More employees at Amazon added their names to a letter that calls on Amazon to take a more aggressive stance on climate change. More than 6,000 employees have signed the letter. That's a tenth of the company's corporate workforce. Among them is a smaller group of 28. They own stock in Amazon, and they filed what's known as an activist shareholder proposal. It asks Amazon to, among other things, cut its greenhouse gas emissions in half over the next 10 years, also to transition away from fossil fuels and to stop making custom solutions for oil and gas companies. Maren Costa in Seattle is one of the 28 co-filers. Her job is principal designer at Amazon. She's been with the company for nearly 15 years. Maren, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Lisa.
You were able to file this shareholder proposal because Amazon had given you stock in the company, as many tech companies do with their employees. How did you and your colleagues in this group of 28 decide to use that shareholder status to pressure Amazon on its environmental record?
Well, a small group of us started just gathering over coffee to talk about our shared interest in climate change. We knew that there had been a shareholder resolution on diversity that had a positive effect and was able to pass, and it seemed like a good lever to press.
So I wonder if you could bring us into those coffee break discussions. What, you know, raised your ire and that of the others in the group?
Personally, I recently let customer service know, just as a customer, that I couldn't support ordering from Amazon Fresh anymore, and that had prior been my sole source of groceries for years. But the packaging seemed to be going in the opposite direction. When it started, there was reusable crates, and all of the packaging you could return, leave it on your doorstep, and it would be picked up the next time your next order came. And then they moved to more paper and plastic, and it was confusing and frustrating, because I love Amazon Fresh. We know that people outside of Amazon have these concerns, people that don't want to work for Amazon or shop at Amazon because they aren't taking a strong enough stance on climate. The millennials are soon to overtake the baby boomers as the largest adult population. They care deeply about climate change. Climate catastrophes are increasingly in the news. Those two things combined together seems like we could potentially be reaching a tipping point where people start to move their dollars to the companies who are really leading in climate change.
Amazon, though, is asking the board not to take up these proposals, not to discuss them. So let's say I'm on the board and you meet me in the elevator and it's a short ride. Tell me why I should vote for this.
I guess my response to that would be, as an Amazon employee and an Amazon customer and an Amazon shareholder, I want to see this company not only survive but continue to thrive. And climate change is an issue that has the capacity to shift entire economies, and I want to make sure we're on the right side of that shift.
Maren Costa, a principal designer at Amazon, one of 28 employees who are also shareholders pushing for Amazon to adopt a more aggressive strategy against climate change. Nice to talk to you, Maren. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we contacted Amazon for this story. A spokesperson said the company is already deeply committed to sustainability and plans to share information about Amazon's company-wide carbon footprint this year for the first time. The spokesperson also noted a program called Shipment Zero as, quote, a vision to make half of Amazon shipments net zero carbon by 2030. Employees say that's not enough to put Amazon in line with the science on climate change. We have a story now about adoption, a process that is filled with paperwork but brings the promise of a new family. There's a growing number of transracial adoptions across the country, and parents are considering how to keep their adoptive child's heritage alive. As Sasha Ann Simons reports from member station WAMU, some experts are working to help families who are unprepared for the challenges that these type of adoptions can bring.
One look at photos lining the walls of this Waldorf, Maryland home, and you can tell the family who lives there has a tight bond. John Paul, Darren Vance, and their 13-year-old son Alexander have been inseparable ever since the couple adopted him as a newborn from Guatemala. And it was an instant mix of three cultures. Paul is an Asian Pacific American from Hawaii, and Vance is white. The couple recalls navigating the usual first-time parent kinks, buckling the baby in his car seat, and the sleepless nights are moments Van says he'll never forget.
There were a couple nights that I actually slept in the crib with him because he just wouldn't stop crying.
When the adoption process was over, Paul and Vance were emotionally drained, especially because of added restrictions gay couples faced just a decade or so ago. Some organizations rejected them because of policies that forbid placing children with same-sex couples. So Paul and Vance were both thrilled and terrified when their adoption agency found a match in Guatemala. And while they don't have many regrets, the couple says they wish they had spent more time fusing the Guatemalan culture with Alexander's life. There were some family discussions over the years, but according to Alexander, he wasn't really interested in his heritage until now.
Knowing my actual parents, like my birth parents, I feel like that would be really cool.
The family only has basic information on Alexander's birth mother. They haven't been back to Guatemala, and Paul admits fear was a factor.
A gay couple traveling with your son, who is originally from there, you just don't want that the political climate could possibly take him away from you or threaten him in any way.
Still, Vance says they plan to return to Guatemala when Alexander is a bit older.
I worry that we've done a disservice through the years by not being perhaps a little more insistent.
Vance and Paul say they would do things differently if adopting a child today. And that's something Vance keeps in mind as he supports other members of the LGBTQ community as executive director of Rainbow Families, a nonprofit in D.C. Through programs and networking events, families gain education they need on their paths to parenthood. Beth Wheeler leads one of the workshops at Rainbow Families. Wheeler is a therapist in the Washington, D.C. area who deals with families adopting children across racial lines. And in her private practice, she says most of her clients are white.
And I will work with them around looking at their own racial identity as white people and looking at white culture and white supremacy and the role of that in how that's going to impact them in their lives, but also in raising children of color.
Wheeler says it can be challenging for her white clients to be comfortable talking openly about race. She says that's because in many cases it wasn't part of their upbringing.
They look at people of color and they, well, that's black and that person's Indian and that person's Japanese, but they don't necessarily consider themselves or say, I'm white.
Wheeler says conversations about race need to start early at transracial adoption homes. And she knows this firsthand. Wheeler is the white mother of two adopted African-American boys who are 9 and 12 years old. She says her social circle began to change over time, and she introduced black men in their lives as role models. The boys attend a summer camp where they can mingle with other adopted children. And Wheeler says she makes sure they see people who look like them wherever they go, even their karate lessons. Wheeler says she answers a ton of questions from her curious boys, but they sometimes still wonder whether they belong. It's a work in progress, she says, and it can also be a challenge getting the outside world to catch up.
The external world will think and be like, oh, isn't this child lucky? Aren't you doing such a wonderful service? Which people have said to me in front of my children.
Meanwhile, back at the Paul Vance home, the couple watch and listen as Alexander plays his bass clarinet. They say music has always been a part of his childhood. Paul has been bringing Alex to Hawaiian cultural events and says he now hula dances better than he does.
Xander actually identifies perhaps more with the Hawaiian culture than Guatemalan culture.
Alexander says he's grown closer to his dad's since he came out as gay 3 years ago. The teen is also gender non-binary, meaning he doesn't identify exclusively with being either male or female. Alexander said he wants to share those details with his biological parents once he reconnects with his Guatemalan roots.
After I find my birth mom and we become actually like we have a bond again, not saying that we lost the bond, but when we brush up on the bond, I would like to ask her, who is my biological father?
As the family tries to figure out whose heritage Alexander will embrace, it's still a complicated issue for them. One which, as he gets older, is really up to the child who's at the center of it all. For Here and Now, I'm Sasha Ann Simons.
The morning started here in New England with a fierce thunderstorm and pouring rain, but that didn't stop thousands of runners, many of whom pulled on huge garbage bags and continued across the finish line of the 123rd Boston Marathon. 30,000 people to be exact, one of the world's largest marathons, although London's later this month will have more than 50,000 on April 28th. To review the Boston Marathon's 26.2-mile course, which starts in rural Hopkinton, Massachusetts, and winds its way through several communities before ending in downtown Boston. We have Here Now's Alex Ashlock at the finish line. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Robin. How you doing?
I'm good. What's it like there now?
It's like it is on every marathon Monday, Robin. People, thousands of people are crossing the finish line. You know, the Boston Marathon is kind of a bucket list thing for marathon runners, the holy grail of marathon runners. So a lot of these people are accomplishing a lifelong goal as they cross the finish line on Boylston Street here in downtown Boston.
And you cannot be
on all afternoon.
Yeah, you cannot be right there at the finish line because it's usually screaming, and like, so you're a little bit away from it. But you were,
I came inside.
Yeah, it's good for you. you sound like you've been up covering this overnight, which you were. You were on the truck ahead of the elite women. So tell us about that race.
Oh, what an incredible performance. Worknesh Degefa of Ethiopia, she breaks away from defending champion Des Linden and all the other women in the race with about 5 miles into the race, and then she runs alone for the last 21 miles to gain her first major marathon victory. She finished in 2 hours, 23 minutes, and 31 seconds. She's the eighth Ethiopian woman to win the Boston Marathon, the third in 7 years. Kenya's Edna Kiplagat was second in the race today. American Jordan Hasse placed third, just like she did in 2017. And Des Linden, she had a bit of a tough day today, but she did end up finishing fifth, not being able to defend her championship from last year, which was the first American woman to win the race since 1985.
Hey, she will always have that. And Alex, will. Our ace reporter, Mackenzie, who is 10, told us that there were three men, like neck and neck with like a mile to go. Tell us about the men's race.
Yeah, I mean, the men's and women's races couldn't have been more different given that just romp to victory in the women's race. These three men come down Boylston Street with only just inches between them. Kenya's Lawrence Chirono ended up being the fastest man in the race today. He was the fastest man in the field coming in. He needed all of that speed today. He outkicked Lalisa Desisa of Ethiopia, passed him just steps away from the tape, and he won the 123rd Boston Marathon in 2 hours, 7 minutes, and 57 seconds. It's his first major victory. Desisa has won here before in 2013 and also in 2015. He took the lead coming down Boylston, but he just couldn't hold it, and Chirono just nipped him at the tape. So it was a big victory for the Kenyan runner.
Well, and just as lots of excitement there.
It was incredible.
And just a thought, in the men's race in 2018, some history was made because it was the first Japanese winner since 1987. So how did that defending champion do today?
Well, the men's defending champion was not able to repeat, just like Des Linden wasn't able to do it in the women's race. Yuki Kawauchi, as you said, making history last year, winning the race as the first Japanese runner in many, many years. He actually finished 17th today, so he did make it across the line, but he was down in the pack as far as the elite runners go. He was looking for rain today, and as you mentioned at the top, it just poured down out. Yeah. In Hopkinton before the race started, but for the most part, the race itself was dry.
Yeah, you had the best wheelchair races in the world, and everybody thinks about them when there's bad weather like that. So what happened in those races?
Well, speaking of that, Tatiana McFadden, the American who won the race last year, she actually had an accident in the slippery conditions at around the 6-mile mark. She flipped her chair. She didn't actually come out of the chair, but she did flip it, so she had to right herself to get back on track. But the accident, maybe it really didn't matter, because Switzerland's Manuel Achard did something similar to what the woman that won the elite women's race did. Manuel Achard ran away from the other wheelchair women in this race. Yes. She won by more than 5 minutes, and McFadden ended up second. So that accident she had with her chair maybe didn't really make that much difference. Over in the men's race, you had American Daniel Romanchuk. He won. He's the first American to win here since 1983. He's a rising star in the wheelchair world, in the men's wheelchair races. He's only 20 years old. He also won the New York Marathon last November. So you're going to look to see him, I think, win more Boston marathons and probably win a lot of these other big city marathons in the future. Again, he's only 20 years old, so he has a really bright future in the sport.
Alex, we only have about a minute left, but we, of course, want to look at the past. This is the exact day that 6 years ago, three people were killed, more than 260 hurt, many lost limbs and have since run this race. But how was it marked today?
Everybody's thinking about it because it is the first time this has happened, the first time the anniversary of the bombings and the race itself have been on the same day. But I think in a way it's a good thing. It makes sense. You know, we've gotten back to running the marathon just like we have for more than 100 years. That day, April 15th, 2013, remains part of the race's history. But the running is also part of the history, too, and we're seeing that today.
Yeah, it is becoming history. Here now is Alex Ashluck at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Alex, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.